be published. From that point, the secrecy was on. It was on just in time to prevent German researchers from pursuing a cheap, effective moderator. Botha's measurement ended German experiments on graphite. Nothing in the record indicates the overestimate was deliberate, but it is worth noting that Walter Botha, a protege of Max Planck, had been hounded from the directorship of the Physics Institute of the University of Heidelberg in 1933 because he was anti-Nazi. "These galling fights so affected my health," he wrote later in a brief unpublished memoir, "that I had to spend a long period in a Badenweiler sanatorium." When Botha was well again, Planck appointed him to the Kaiser Wilhelm Society's Heidelberg Physics Institute. But the Nazis continued to harass me, even to the accusation of scientific fraud. At nearly the same time, early 1941, Hartek learned at Hamburg what Otto Frisch had recently learned at Liverpool. Frisch had moved to the industrial port city in the northwest of England to work with Chadwick and Chadwick's cyclotron. He built a Clusius tube there with a student assistant Chadwick assigned him. They moved in such energetic coordination through the laboratory that they won the nickname Frisch and Chips, and discovered, says Frisch, that uranium hexafluoride is one of the gases for which the Clusius method does not work. The discovery set the British program back not at all, since Simon was already hard at work on gaseous barrier diffusion. But the German researchers had placed such faith in thermal diffusion that they had not bothered to develop alternatives. They quickly began doing so and identified several promising methods. Oddly enough, barrier diffusion was not among them. Restudying the separation problem made it even clearer that U-235 and U-238 could only be separated by brute force methods, and at great expense. When Hartek reported to the War Office in March 1941, following a conference with his colleagues, he stressed their consensus that isotope separation would be feasible only for special applications in which cheapness is but a secondary consideration. Only for a bomb, he meant, so he told the historian David Irving after the war. The German physicists gave special applications second place on their list. They recommended urgent work first on all of the production of heavy water. Like Fermi and Szilard, they opted initially for a slow neutron chain reaction in natural uranium. Make that reaction work, and special applications might follow. Knowing no more than they knew, they hardly had a choice. Lieutenant Colonel Suzuki reported back to Lieutenant General Yasuda in October 1940. He confined his report to a basic issue, the availability to Japan of uranium deposits. He looked beyond Japan to Korea and Burma and concluded that his country had access to sufficient uranium. A bomb was therefore possible. Yasuda turned then to the director of Japan's Physical and Chemical Research Institute, who passed the problem on to his country's leading physicist, Yoshio Nishina. Nishina, born late in the Meiji era and 50 years old in 1940, known for theoretical work on the Compton effect, had studied with Niels Bohr in Copenhagen, where he was remembered as a cosmopolitan and exceptional man. He had built a small cyclotron at his Tokyo laboratory, the Riken, and with help from an assistant who had trained at Berkeley, was building in 1940 a 60-inch successor with a 250-ton magnet, the plans for which had been donated by Ernest Lawrence. More than 100 young Japanese scientists, the cream of the crop, worked under Nishina at the Riken. To them, he was Oyabun, the old man, and he ran his laboratory Western style with warmth and informality. The Riken began measuring cross-sections in December. In April 1941, the official order came through. The Imperial Army Air Force authorized research toward the development of an atomic bomb. Leo Szilard was known by now throughout the American physics community as the leading apostle of secrecy in fission matters. To his mailbox, late in May 1940, came a puzzled note from a Princeton physicist, Louis A. Turner. Turner had written a letter to the editor of the Physical Review, a copy of which he enclosed. It was entitled, Atomic Energy from U-238, and he wondered if it should be withheld from publication. It seems as if it was wild enough speculation so that it could do no possible harm, Turner told Szilard, but that is for someone else to say. Turner had published a masterly 29-page review article on nuclear fission in the January Reviews of Modern Physics, citing nearly 100 papers that had appeared since Hahn and Strassmann reported their discovery 12 months earlier. The number of papers indicates the impact of the discovery on physics and the rush of physicists to explore it. Turner had also noted the recent Nyer-Columbia report confirming the attribution of slow neutron fission to U-235. He could hardly have missed it. The New York Times and other newspapers publicized the story widely. He wrote Szilard irritably or ingenuously that he found it a little difficult to figure out the guiding principle of keeping fission research secret, in view of the recent ample publicity given to the separation of isotopes. His reading for the review article and the new Columbia measurements had stimulated him to further thought. The result was his physical review letter. Since U-235 is responsible for slow neutron fission, the letter pointed out, and ordinary uranium contains only one part in 140 of that isotope, it is natural to conclude that only 1/140th of any quantity of U can be considered as a possible source of atomic energy if slow neutrons are to be used. But the truth may be otherwise, Turner went on. The fission energy of most of the U-238, if it could not be used directly, might yet find indirect release. Turner was referring to the possibility that bombarding uranium with neutrons converted some of the uranium to transuranic elements, the transuranics that Bohr had hoped might have been banished by the discovery of fission. When an atom of U-238 captured a neutron, it became the isotope U-239. That substance itself might fission, Turner suggested. But whether or not U-239 did so, it was energetically unstable and would probably decay by beta emission to new elements heavier than uranium. And one or more of those new elements might be fissionable by slow neutrons, which would thereby indirectly put U-238 to work. The next element up the periodic table from uranium would be element 93. Turner selected as the likeliest candidate for fission not 93X239, however, but the element next along, the element that 93 would probably decay to, 94X239, which he called Eca-osmium. And 94Eca-os-239, Turner proposed, changing from an odd to an even number of neutrons when it absorbed a neutron preparatory to fissioning, 239 nucleons minus 94 protons equals 145 neutrons plus 1 equals 146, just as U-235 changed to U-236, ought to be even more fissionable than the lighter uranium isotope. In 94Eca-os-240, the excess energy would be even larger than in 92U-236, and a large cross-section for fission would be expected. While Turner was thinking these theories through, two Berkeley men, Edwin M. McMillan and Philip M. Abelson, were moving independently toward demonstrating them. McMillan, a slim, freckled, California-born experimentalist, had been one of the men most responsible in the 1930s for improving Ernest Lawrence's cyclotrons to the point where they worked steadily and produced reliable results. Soon after the news of the discovery of fission reached Berkeley in late January 1939, he had devised an elegantly simple experiment to explore the phenomenon. When a nucleus of uranium absorbs a neutron and fission takes place, McMillan told an audience later, the two resulting fragments fly apart with great violence, sufficient to propel them through the air or other matter for some distance. This distance, called the range, is a quantity of some interest, and I undertook to measure it. He did so first with thin sheets of aluminum foil, like the pages of a book, stacked on a layer of uranium oxide backed with filter paper. He bombarded the uranium with slow neutrons. Some of the fission fragments recoiled up into the stack of foils. Each fragment embedded itself in a single sheet of foil at the end of its range, which depended on its mass. McMillan could then simply check successive sheets of foil in an ionization chamber, look for the characteristic half-lives of various fission products, and read out the range. The uranium nucleus splits in many different ways, producing many different lighter element nuclei. But aluminum itself is activated by neutron bombardment, which made half-life measurements difficult. So Macmillan replaced the foils with a stack of cigarette papers previously treated with acid to remove any trace of minerals that might develop radioactivity under bombardment. Nothing very interesting about the fission fragments came out of this, he comments. The uranium coating on the filter paper under the stack of cigarette papers, on the other hand, showed something very interesting. It showed two half-life activities different from those of the fission products that had recoiled away. And since whatever had remained in the uranium layer had not recoiled, the two different activities were probably not fission products. They were probably radioactivities induced in the uranium by captured neutrons. Macmillan suspected that one of the two activities, the one with a half-life of 23 minutes, was the one that Hahn, Meitner, and Strassmann had identified in the 1930s as U-239, a uranium isotope produced by resonance neutron capture. The other activity, left behind in the uranium layer, had a longer half-life, about 2 days. In his report on his foil and cigarette paper experiments, Macmillan chose not to speculate on what that second activity might be. But privately, he remembers, he thought the 2-day period could be the product of the beta decay of U-239, and therefore an isotope of transuranic element 93. In fact, this was the most reasonable explanation. To check that explanation, Macmillan needed some hint of the substance's chemical identity. He expected that element 93 would behave chemically like the metal rhenium, element 75, next to osmium on the periodic table, would be ica-rhenium in the old terminology. He bombarded a larger uranium sample and enlisted the aid of Emilio Segre, who is now working as a research associate at Berkeley. Segre was very familiar with the chemistry of rhenium, since he and his co-workers studying rhenium had discovered a similar element, now called technetium, in 1937. Segre began a chemical analysis of the irradiated uranium. In the meantime, Macmillan sharpened his half-life measurement to 2.3 days. Segre, says Macmillan, showed that the 2.3-day material had none of the properties of rhenium, and indeed acted like a rare earth instead. The rare earths, elements 57, lanthanum, to 71, lutetium, form a chemically closely related and odd series between barium and hafnium. Because of their middle table atomic weights near barium, they often turn up as fission products. When Segre found the 2.3-day activity acting not like rhenium, as expected, but like a rare earth, Macmillan assumed that was what it was. Since rare earths are prominent among the fission products, this discovery seemed at the time to end the story. Segre even published a paper on his work titled An Unsuccessful Search for Transuranic Elements. Macmillan might have left it there, but the fact that the 2.3-day substance did not recoil away from the uranium layer nagged at him. As time went on and the fission process became better understood, I found it increasingly difficult to believe that one fission product should behave in a way so different from the rest, and early in 1940 I returned to the problem. The 60-inch cyclotron, with a massive rectangular-framed magnet spacious enough to shelter Lawrence's entire crew between its poles for a photograph, 27 men, two rows seated on the lower jaw of the beast, Lawrence prominent at center, and a third row standing inside its maw, was up and running by then. Macmillan used it to study the 2.3-day activity in more detail. He studied the activity chemically as well and managed the significant observation that it did not always fractionally crystallize out of solution, as a rare earth would. By now was the spring of 1940, Macmillan continues, and Dr. Philip Abelson came to Berkeley for a short vacation. Abelson was the young experimentalist for whose benefit Luis Alvarez had vacated his Berkeley barber chair, half-shorn, to pass along the news of the discovery of fission. He had finished his Berkeley PhD and signed on with Merle Tuve at the DTM. Like Macmillan, he had become suspicious of the conclusion that the 2.3-day activity was merely another rare-earth fission product. He found time, in April 1940, to begin sorting out its chemistry. Although he was a physicist by graduate training, he had earned his B.S. in chemistry at Washington State. but he needed a bigger sample of bombarded uranium than he could produce with DTM equipment. When he arrived for his vacation, says McMillan, and our mutual interests became known to one another, we decided to work together. McMillan made up a new batch of irradiated uranium. Abelson pursued its chemistry. Within a day, Abelson recalls, I established that the 2.3-day activity had chemical properties different from those of any known element. It behaved much like uranium. Apparently, the transuranics were not metals like rhenium and osmium, but were part of a new series of rare earth-like elements similar to uranium. For a rigorous proof that they had found a transuranic, the two men isolated a pure uranium sample with strong 23-minute U-239 activity and demonstrated with half-life measurements that the 2.3-day activity increased in intensity as the 23-minute activity declined. If the 2.3-day activity was different chemically from any other element and was created in the decay of U-239, then it must be element 93. McMillan and Abelson wrote up their results. McMillan had already thought of a name for the new element, Neptunium, for the next planet out beyond Uranus. But they chose not to offer the name in their report. They mailed the report, Radioactive Element 93, to the Physical Review on May 27, 1940, the same day Lewis Turner sent Szilard his transuranic theories. Anticipation and discovery can cut that close in science. Presumably, Szilard did not yet know of the Berkeley work, published June 15th, when he answered Turner's letter on May 30th, since he makes no mention of it. But he recognized the logic of Turner's argument, told him it might eventually turn out to be a very important contribution, and proposed he keep it secret. Szilard saw beyond what Turner had seen. He saw that a fissile element bred in uranium could be chemically separated away, that the relatively easy and relatively inexpensive process of chemical separation could replace the horrendously difficult and expensive process of physical separation of isotopes as a way to make a bomb. But unstable element 93, Neptunium, was not yet that fissile element, and Szilard did not yet realize how small a quantity of pure fissile material was needed to make a critical mass. Turner was first with his observation, but he was not alone. The idea occurred independently to von Weizsäcker one day in July before the June Physical Review reached him in Germany with the McMillan-Abelson news while he was riding the Berlin subway, though he assumed Element 93 would do the job. He offered the idea to the War Office in a 5-page report. A British team at the Cavendish worked it out and presented it to the Maud Committee in early 1941. But the Germans thought only heavy water could make a uranium burner go in which the new elements might breed, and the British had become optimistic about isotope separation. Neither group, therefore, pursued the Turner approach. After Abelson returned to Washington, McMillan pressed on. Unstable neptunium decayed by beta emission with a 2.3-day half-life. He suspected it decayed to element 94. By analogy with uranium, which emits alpha particles naturally, element 94 should also be a natural alpha emitter. McMillan therefore looked for alphas with ranges different from the uranium alphas coming off his mixed uranium-neptunium samples. By autumn, he had identified them. He tried some chemical separations, finding that the alpha activity did not belong to an isotope of protactinium, uranium, or neptunium. He was that close. But American science, spurred on by British appeals, was finally gearing up for war. Churchill had sent over Henry Tizard in the late summer of 1940 with a delegation of experts and a black enameled metal steamer trunk, the original black box, full of military secrets. The prize specimen among them was the cavity magnetron developed in Mark Oliphant's laboratory at Birmingham. John Cockcroft, a future Nobel laureate with a vital mission, traveled along to explain the high-powered microwave generator. The Americans had never seen anything like it before. Cockcroft got together one weekend in October with Ernest Lawrence and multimillionaire physicist financier Alfred Loomis, the last of the gentlemen scientists, at Loomis's private laboratory in the elegant suburban New York colony of Tuxedo Park. That meeting laid the groundwork for a major new NDRC laboratory at MIT. To keep its work secret, it was named the Radiation Laboratory, as if serious scientists might actually be pursuing applications so dubious as those bruited by visionaries from nuclear physics. Loomis wanted Lawrence to direct the new laboratory. Lawrence preferred to stay at Berkeley, laying plans and raising funds for a new 184-inch cyclotron, but was willing to encourage his best people to move to Cambridge. He convinced Macmillan, "I left Berkeley in November 1940 to take part in the development of radar for national defense. Lawrence's and Macmillan's priorities are a measure of the priorities of American science in late 1940. Peacetime cyclotrons and radar for air defense came first, before superbombs." With a different perspective on the matter, James Chadwick at Liverpool was so uncharacteristically incensed by the publication of the Macmillan-Abelson paper reporting Element 93 that he asked for, and got, an official protest through the British Embassy. An attaché was duly dispatched to Berkeley to scold Ernest Lawrence, the 1939 Nobel laureate in physics, for giving away secrets to the Germans in perilous times. Laura and Enrico Fermi and their two children had moved from a Manhattan apartment in the summer of 1939 across the George Washington Bridge and beyond the Palisades to the pleasant suburb of Leonia, New Jersey. Harold Urey, a short, intense, enthusiastic man, was a resident along with other Columbia families and had convinced the Fermis to buy a house there, praising Leonia's excellent public schools, Laura writes, and extolling the advantages of living in a middle-class town where one's children may have all that other children have. Among much good advice, Urey cautioned the Italian couple to wage eternal war on crabgrass. Fermi was a product of Roman apartments. He quickly identified Digitaria sanguinalis neutrally as an unlicensed annual and chose to ignore it. Laura prepared to do battle but was unable to distinguish crabgrass from sod. Urey dropped by one day to give her counsel and identified the problem. "Do you know what's wrong with your lawn, Laura?" the chemistry laureate asked her compassionately. "It's all crabgrass." Life was pleasant in Leonia. Fermi practiced fitting in. Segre remembers that his friend purposely studied contemporary Americana and read the comic strips. "Among adult immigrants, I have never seen a comparably earnest effort toward Americanization." Segre traveled to Indiana toward the end of 1940 to interview at Purdue, perfunctory interviewing, because he meant to stay at Berkeley. "The machine was so good. I could do these things that nowhere else could I do." He continued eastward to visit the Fermis in Leonia. Independently of Turner, Segre recalls, both he and Fermi had been thinking about Element 94. "On December 15th, he writes, "we had a long walk along the Hudson, in freezing weather, during which we spoke of the possibility that the isotope of mass 239 of element 94 might be a slow neutron fissioner. If this proved to be true, it could substitute for 235U as a nuclear explosive. Furthermore, a nuclear reactor fueled with ordinary uranium would produce the new element. This gave an entirely new perspective on the making of nuclear explosives, eliminating the need to separate uranium isotopes, at that time a truly scary problem." Lawrence happened to be visiting New York. Fermi, Lawrence, Pegram, and I met in Dean Pegram's office at Columbia University and developed plans for a cyclotron irradiation that could produce a sufficient amount of element 94. After Christmas, Segre returned to Berkeley. A young chemist there, Glenn T. Seaborg, had already begun working toward identifying and isolating element 94. Born in Michigan of Swedish-American parents, Seaborg had grown up in Los Angeles and taken his Ph.D. at Berkeley in chemistry in 1937, when he was 25. He was exceptionally tall, thin, guarded in the Swedish way, but gifted and comfortable at work. The published record of Otto Hahn's 1933 Cornell lectures, Applied Radiochemistry, had been his guidebook in grad school. Radiochemistry was his passion. He had been practicing it at Berkeley in January 1939 when the news of fission arrived. Like Philip Abelson, he was excited by the discovery and chagrined to have missed it, and had walked the streets for hours the night he heard. As early as the end of August, he had bombarded a sample of uranium to produce neptunium and had assigned one of his second-year graduate students, Arthur C. Wall, to study its chemistry. His other collaborator in the search for 94 was Joseph W. Kennedy, like Seaborg, a Berkeley chemistry instructor. By late November, the group had progressed through four more bombardments, unraveling enough of neptunium's chemistry to devise techniques for isolating highly purified samples. Seaborg then wrote Macmillan at MIT, a letter he summarizes in a careful history he wrote later that he cast as a contemporary diary. I suggested that since he has now left Berkeley, and is therefore not in a position to continue this work of studying neptunium and looking for element 94, that we would be very glad to carry on in his absence as his collaborators. Macmillan acceded in mid-December. By the time Segre returned to Berkeley, Seaborg had separated out significant fractions of material from his bombarded samples, including uranium, fission products, purified neptunium, and a rare earth fraction that might contain 94. Two searches were thus to proceed simultaneously. Seaborg's team would follow one especially intense alpha emitter it had identified in the hope of demonstrating that it was an isotope of 94, chemically different from all other known elements. At the same time, Segre and Seaborg would produce neptunium-239 in quantity, look for its decay product, which ought to be 94-239, and attempt to measure that substance's fissibility. Segre and Seaborg bombarded 10 grams of a solid uranium compound, uranyl nitrate hexahydrate, UNH, for 6 hours in the 60-inch cyclotron on January 9th. They bombarded 5 more grams for an hour the next morning. By afternoon, they knew from ionization chamber measurements that they could make 94 by cyclotron bombardment. 1 kilogram of UNH, they calculated, suitably irradiated, should produce about 0.6 microgram, 1 millionth of a gram, from neptunium after allowing time for beta decay. Seaborg's team identified an alpha-emitting daughter of NP-238 on January 20th. Definitive proof that it was 94 required chemical separation, and that delicate, tedious work proceeded during February. The crucial breakthrough came at the beginning of a week when everyone routinely labored past midnight to pursue the difficult fractionations to their end. On Sunday afternoon, February 23rd, Wall discovered he could precipitate the alpha emitter from acid solution using thorium as a carrier. But he was not then able to separate the alpha emitter from the thorium. He talked to a Berkeley chemistry professor who suggested using a more powerful oxidizing agent. That evening, Seaborg and Segre began bombarding 1.2 kilograms of UNH in the 60-inch cyclotron to transmute some of its uranium into neptunium. They packed the UNH into glass tubes, set the tubes in holes drilled into a 10-inch block of paraffin, and set the paraffin in a wooden box. Then they arranged the wooden box behind the beryllium target of the big cyclotron, which battered copious quantities of neutrons from the beryllium with powerful 16 MeV deuterons, favorite cyclotron projectiles, deuterium nuclei from heavy water. With the UNH in place in the cyclotron, Seaborg climbed the stairs to the third floor of Gilman Hall, where Wall brewed fractionations under the roof in a cramped room relieved by a small balcony. Wall tried the new oxidation chemistry that evening with Seaborg at his side. It worked. The thorium precipitated from solution and the alpha emitter stayed behind, enough of it to read out about 300 kicks per minute on the linear amplifier. That, writes Seaborg, was the key step in its discovery. But they still needed a precipitate of the alpha emitter, and they pushed on through the night. Seaborg remembers noticing the new day, lightning over San Francisco to the west across the bay, when he stepped out onto the balcony to clear his lungs of fumes. Working again past midnight on Tuesday, Wall filtered out a precipitate cleared of thorium. With this final separation from TH, Seaborg records with emphasis, it has been demonstrated that our alpha activity can be separated from all known elements, and thus it is now clear that our alpha activity is due to the new element with the atomic number 94. The bombardment of Segre's and Seaborg's kilogram sample, interrupted from time to time by other experiments that commanded the cyclotron, continued for a week. The UNH was rendered more intensely radioactive. The radioactivity would increase dangerously as they concentrated the NP-239 they had made. They began working with goggles and lead shielding, dissolving the uranium first in 2 liters of ether, and then proceeding through a series of laborious precipitations. Their fifth and sixth re-precipitations they finished on Thursday, March 6th. From 1.2 kilograms of UNH, they had now separated less than a millionth of a gram of pure NP-239 mixed with sufficient carrier to stain a miniature platinum dish that measured 2/3 of an inch across and 1/2 inch deep. When they had dried this speck of matter God had not welcomed at the creation, they simply snipped off the sides of the platinum dish, covered the sample with a protective layer of Duco cement, glued the dish to a piece of cardboard labeled Sample A, and set it aside until it decayed completely to 94-239. On Friday, March 28th, of the week when Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, commander of the Africa Corps, opened a major offensive in North Africa, when the British meat ration was reduced to 6 ounces per person per week, when British torpedo bombers successfully attacked the Italian fleet as it returned from the Aegean, a performance that greatly interested the Japanese, Seaborg recorded, "This morning, Kennedy, Segre, and I made our first test for the fissionability of 94-239 using sample A. Kennedy has constructed during the past few weeks a portable ionization chamber and linear amplifier suitable for detecting fission pulses. Sample A, estimated to contain 0.25 micrograms of 94-239, was placed near the screened window of the ionization chamber embedded in paraffin near the beryllium target of the 37-inch cyclotron. The neutrons produced by the irradiation of the beryllium target with 8 MeV deuterons give a fission rate of 1 count per minute per microampere. When the ionization chamber is surrounded by a cadmium shield, the fission rate drops to essentially zero. This gives strong indications that 94-239 undergoes fission with slow neutrons." Not until 1942 would they officially propose a name for the new element that fissioned like U-235 but could be chemically separated from uranium. But Seaborg already knew what he would call it. Consistent with Martin Klaproth's inspiration in 1789 to link his discovery of a new element with the recent discovery of the planet Uranus, and with Macmillan's suggestion to extend the scheme to Neptune, Seaborg would name element 94 for Pluto, the ninth planet outward from the sun, discovered in 1930 and named for the Greek god of the underworld, a god of the Earth's fertility, but also the god of the dead. Plutonium. Friesch and Pirls had calculated a small U-235 critical mass on the basis of sensible theory. Through the winter, Merle Touvet's group at the DTM had continued to refine its cross-section measurements. In March, Touvet was able to send to England a measured U-235 fast fission cross-section that the British used to confirm a critical mass somewhat larger than the Friesch-Pirls estimate, about 18 pounds untamped, 9 or 10 pounds surrounded by a suitably massive and reflective tamper. "This first test of theory," Pirls wrote triumphantly that month, "has given a completely positive answer, and there is no doubt that the whole scheme is feasible, provided the technical problems of isotope separation are satisfactorily solved, and that the critical size for a U-sphere is manageable." Chadwick had also made further cross-section measurements. He was already a sober man. When he saw the new numbers, a more intense sobriety seized him. He described the change in 1969 in an interview. "I remember the spring of 1941 to this day. I realized then that a nuclear bomb was not only possible, it was inevitable. Sooner or later, these ideas could not be peculiar to us. Everybody would think about them before long, and some country would put them into action. And I had nobody to talk to. You see, the chief people in the laboratory were Frisch and Polish experimental physicist Joseph Rotblat. However high my opinion of them was, they were not citizens of this country, and the others were quite young boys, and there was nobody to talk to about it. I had many sleepless nights. But I did realize how very serious it could be, and I had then to start taking sleeping pills. It was the only remedy. I've never stopped since then. It's 28 years, and I don't think I've missed a single night in all those 28 years. 12. A Communication from Britain. James Bryant Conant traveled to London in the winter of 1941 to open a liaison office between the British government and the National Defense Research Council. Conant was the first American scientist of administrative rank to visit the beleaguered nation following the ad hoc exchanges of the Tizard mission, and he came to count the trip the most extraordinary experience of my life. "I was hailed as a messenger of hope," he writes in his autobiography. "I saw a stout-hearted population under bombardment. I saw an unflinching government with its back against the wall. Almost every hour I saw or heard something that made me proud to be a member of the human race." The Harvard president, who would be 47 late in March, was welcomed not only because of his university affiliation or his distinction as a member of the NDRC. He had been an outspoken opponent of American isolationism during the long months of the phony war, and was therefore welcomed especially as a sign, with only the prime minister dissenting. Churchill was less than delighted at the prospect of lunching with the president of Harvard. "What shall I talk to him about?" he was heard to ask. "He thought you would be an old man with a white beard, exuding learning and academic formality," Brendan Bracken, Churchill's aide, told Conant afterward. But braced by the American's belligerently pro-British views and put at ease by the tweed suit he chose to wear, the Prime Minister eventually warmed over lunch in the bomb shelter basement at 10 Downing Street, proffering a Churchillian monologue during which he repeated one of his choicer recent coinages: "Give us the tools and we'll finish the job." In 1920, at 27, when Conant was courting the woman he would marry, she was the only child of the Nobel laureate Harvard chemist T.W. Richards, a pioneer in measuring atomic weights, he had shared hopes for a grand future with her that coming from a less able man might have sounded absurd. "I said that I had three ambitions. The first was to become the leading organic chemist in the United States. After that, I would like to be president of Harvard. And after that, a cabinet member, perhaps Secretary of the Interior." Those may not seem conjoint ambitions, but Conant managed a version of each in turn. He was born of a Massachusetts family that had resided in the state since 1623. After Roxbury Latin and Harvard College, he had taken a double Ph.D. under his future father-in-law in organic and physical chemistry. He emerged from the Great War with the rank of major, for his work in poison gas research at Edgewood. In his autobiography, written late in life, he justified his participation. "I did not see in 1917, and do not see in 1968, why tearing a man's guts out by a high-explosive shell is to be preferred to maiming him by attacking his lungs or skin. All war is immoral. Logically, the 100% pacifist has the only impregnable position. Once that is abandoned, as it is when a nation becomes a belligerent, one can talk sensibly only in terms of the violation of agreements about the way war is conducted, or the consequences of a certain tactic or weapon." Like Vannevar Bush, Conant was a patriot who believed in the application of advanced technology to war. Conant achieved an international reputation in both natural products chemistry and in physical organic chemistry, writes the Ukrainian-born Harvard chemist George B. Kistakowski. Natural products include chlorophyll and hemoglobin, and Conant contributed to the unraveling of both those vital molecules. His studies also helped generalize the concept of acids and bases, a concept now considered fundamental. If not the leading American organic chemist of his day, he ranked among the leaders. When Caltech tried to lure him away with a large research budget, Harvard topped the offer and refused to let him go. Number two on Conant's youthful list, the presidency of his alma mater, he won in 1933. He told the members of the Harvard Corporation who approached him that he didn't want the job, which was apparently a prerequisite, but would serve if elected. He was 40 at the time of his election. He created the modern Harvard of eminent scholarship and publish or perish, up or out. Conant's third ambition achieved approximate fulfillment after the war in high, though less than cabinet rank, appointment. His long span of voluntary government service began with the NDRC. In England, in the late winter of 1941, he met with the leaders of the British government, had an audience with the King, picked up an honorary degree at Cambridge, and walked the backs afterward to see the crocuses in bloom, made room for the NDRC mission among hostile U.S. military and naval attachés, lunched with Churchill again. His mission in Britain was diplomatic rather than technical. He discussed gas warfare and explosives manufacture, but was unable to share in the intense exchange of information on radar because he knew very little about electronics. But although he was familiar with the work on uranium, and it fell within his official NDRC responsibilities, secrecy and his strong belief in the need-to-know principle kept Conant from learning what the British had learned about the possibility of a bomb. He met a French scientist at Oxford, probably Hans von Halben, who complained of inaction on uranium heavy water research. Since his complaints were clearly out of channels, I quickly terminated the conversation and forgot the incident. That reaction was understandable. Conant could hardly know what security arrangements the British might have made with the Free French. But he also shied from Lindemann. They were lunching alone at a London club. He introduced the subject of the study of the fission of uranium atoms. I reacted by repeating the doubts I had expressed and heard expressed at NDRC meetings. Lindemann brushed them aside and pounced. "You have left out consideration," said Lindemann, "the possibility of the construction of a bomb of enormous power." "How would that be possible?" I asked. "By first separating uranium-235, he said, "and then arranging for the two portions of the element to be brought together suddenly, so that the resulting mass would spontaneously undergo a self-sustaining reaction." Remarkably, the chairman of the Chemistry and Explosives Division of the NDRC adds that, as late as March 1941, "This was the first I had heard about even the remote possibility of a bomb." Nor did he pursue the matter. I assumed, quite correctly, that if and when Bush wished to be in touch with the atomic energy work in England, he would do so through channels involving Briggs. No wonder the Hungarian conspirers continued to tear their hair. Then, for the first time, a ranking American physicist joined the debate whose voice could not be ignored. Even before Seaborg and Segre confirmed the feasibility of plutonium, Ernest Lawrence had measured the prevailing American skepticism and conservatism against the increasing enthusiasm of his British friends, and responded with characteristic fervor. Ralph H. Fowler, Ernest Rutherford's widower's son-in-law, had visited Berkeley during the 1930s and attended picnics and weekend parties with the inventor of the cyclotron. Fowler was British scientific liaison officer in Washington now, and from that close vantage, he urged Lawrence to get involved. So did Mark Oliphant, whom Lawrence had met and liked on a visit to the Cavendish after the 1933 Solvay conference. Lawrence had encouraged the search for plutonium partly because he saw little hope for isotope separation by any of the methods so far discussed, by centrifuge, thermal diffusion, or barrier diffusion. But around the beginning of the year, he began thinking about separating isotopes electromagnetically, by the process that had already worked on a microscopic scale for Alfred Nier. It occurred to Lawrence that he could modify his superseded 37-inch cyclotron into a big mass spectrometer. The fact that Nyer thought electromagnetic separation on an industrial scale impossible only spurred the Berkeley laureate on. Lawrence lived from machine to machine, as it were, conceiving a machine to do the job of liberating U-235 from its confinement within U-238, while Fermi's uranium graphite reactor manufactured Berkeley-born plutonium gave him something solid to fight for, a tangible program to push. It assembled itself by stages. He was not yet ready emotionally to set aside his peacetime plans. Warren Weaver, the director of the Division of Natural Sciences at the Rockefeller Foundation, visited Berkeley in February to see how construction was progressing on the 4,900-ton, 184-inch cyclotron,
for which the foundation had awarded a $1,150,000 grant less than 12 months earlier.
Lawrence took time to complain about the Uranium Committee's sloth. Weaver worked with another division of the NDRC, but then drove up behind the university to the cyclotron site on the hillside and first irritated and then enthralled the Rockefeller administrator with visions of a superior and much larger machine. Lawrence rehearsed his complaint again in March when Conant, back from London, traveled out to deliver an address. "Light a fire under the Briggs Committee," the energetic Californian badgered the president of Harvard. "What if German scientists succeed in making a nuclear bomb before we even investigate possibilities?" That prepared Lawrence for a full assault. He launched it on March 17th when he met with Carl Compton and Alfred Loomis at MIT. Loomis had turned to physics after a lucrative career in the law and investment banking. Compton was a physicist of distinction who had taught for 15 years at Princeton, where he took his PhD before becoming president of MIT in 1930. Both men understood the politics of organizations. Yet they were sufficiently seized with Lawrence's fervor that Compton telephoned Vannevar Bush almost as soon as Lawrence left the room and dictated a follow-up letter the same day. Briggs was, by nature, slow, conservative, methodical, and accustomed to operate at peacetime government bureau tempo, Compton wrote, conveying Lawrence's blunt complaints, and had been following a policy consistent with these qualities and still further inhibited by the requirement of secrecy. The British were ahead, even though America had the most in number and the best in quality of the nuclear physicists of the world. The Germans were very active. Briggs had invited only a very few U.S. nuclear physicists into the work. There were other possibilities in fission research, besides the pursuit of a slow neutron chain reaction for power, possibilities capable, if successful, of far more important military usage. Though they felt free thus to lecture Bush, both Loomis and Compton stood in awe of Lawrence. Loomis had recently contributed $30,000 to a private fund simply to make it easier for Lawrence to travel around the country, and thought Bush could do no better than to turn him loose. I hasten to say that the idea of Ernest himself taking an active part in any reorganization was in no sense suggested by him or even in his mind, but I do believe that it would be an ideal solution. Bush's ego was commensurate with his responsibilities, as Loomis and Compton ought to have known. It might have been politic to welcome Lawrence's campaign, especially since Loomis was a first cousin and close friend of Henry L. Stimson, the respected and influential Secretary of War. But Bush decided instead to take it as a challenge to his authority, the first the physics community had mounted since he invented the NDRC, welcoming a fight he knew he could win. He met Lawrence in New York 2 days after the MIT meeting and let fly. "I told him flatly that I was running the show, that we had established a procedure for handling it, that he could either conform to that as a member of the NDRC and put his kicks through the internal mechanism, or he could be utterly on the outside and act as an individual in any way that he saw fit. He got into line, and I arranged for him to have with Briggs a series of excellent conferences. However, I made it very clear to Lawrence that I proposed to make available to Briggs the best advice and consultation possible, but that, in the last analysis, I proposed to back up Briggs and his committee in their decision, unless there was some decidedly strong case for entering into it personally. I think this matter was thoroughly straightened out, therefore, but it left its trail behind. By threatening to push Ernest Lawrence out into the cold with the émigrés, Bush managed temporarily to confine the uranium problem. Confinement lasted less than a month. In 1940, Lawrence had recruited a Harvard experimentalist named Kenneth Bainbridge, by trade a nuclear physicist. Bainbridge built the Harvard cyclotron, to work on radar at MIT. When Conant went to London to open the new NDRC office there, Bainbridge and others had followed to work with the British, each in his own field of competence. But since Bainbridge knew nuclear physics as well as radar, and had even looked into isotope separation, the British allowed him also to attend a full-dress meeting of the Maud Committee. To Bainbridge's surprise, the committee had a very good idea of the critical mass and bomb assembly mechanism, and urged the exchange of personnel. Their estimate was that a minimum of 3 years would be required to solve all the problems involved in producing an atomic weapon. Bainbridge immediately contacted Briggs and suggested he send someone over to represent the United States in uranium matters. Beneath Bush's organizational bristle lay genuine perplexity. "I'm no atomic scientist," he writes candidly. "Most of this was over my head." As he saw the situation that April, it would be possible to spend a very large amount of money indeed, and yet there is certainly no clear-cut path to defense results of great importance lying open before us at the present time. But he felt the increasing pressure, Lawrence's prodding, Bainbridge's confirmation of British progress, and reached out now for help. "It was Bush's strategy," writes the American experimental physicist Arthur Compton, Carl's younger brother, "as coordinator of the nation's war research, to use the National Academy of Sciences as the court of final appeal for important scientific problems. On a Tuesday in mid-April, after meeting with Briggs, Bush wrote Frank B. Jewett, the senior Bell telephone engineer who was president of the National Academy. Briggs had heard from Bainbridge and alerted Bush. Bush and Briggs, disturbed, had conferred. The British are apparently doing fully as much as we are, if not more, and yet it seems as though, if the problem were of really great importance, we ought to be carrying most of the burden in this country." Bush wanted an energetic but dispassionate review of the entire situation by a highly competent group of physicists. The men chosen ought to have sufficient knowledge to understand and sufficient detachment to cold-bloodedly evaluate. At a regular Washington meeting of the National Academy, the following Friday, Jewett, Bush, and Briggs recruited their review group. They put Lawrence on the committee, and the recently retired director of the research laboratory at General Electric, a physical chemist named William D. Coolidge. Then they sought out Arthur Compton, a Nobel laureate and professor of physics at the University of Chicago, and proposed he head the review. Compton humbly questioned his fitness for the task and jumped at the chance. Arthur Holly Compton was the son of a Presbyterian minister and professor of philosophy at the College of Worcester in Worcester, Ohio. Compton's Mennonite mother was dedicated to missionary causes and had been the 1939 American Mother of the Year. He followed his older brother Carl into science and surpassed him in achievement, but preserved the family piety as well. "Arthur Compton and God were daily companions," notes Leona Woods, Enrico Fermi's young protege at the University of Chicago. She judged Compton, nevertheless, a fine scientist and a fine man. He was remarkably handsome all his life and athletically spare and strong. Fermi had concluded, writes Woods, that tallness and handsomeness usually were inversely proportional to intelligence. But he accepted Arthur Compton, whose intelligence he respected enormously. Compton's physics was first rate, as Fermi's respect implies. He graduated from the College of Worcester and took his PhD at Princeton. In 1919, the first year of the program, he was appointed a National Research Council Fellow and used the appointment to study under Rutherford at the Cavendish. The difficult work he began there, examining the scattering and absorption of gamma rays, led directly to the discovery of what came to be called the Compton effect, for which he won the Nobel Prize. In 1920, Compton writes, he accepted a professorship at Washington University in St. Louis, a small kind of place, to get out of the mainstream of physics so that he could concentrate on his scattering studies, which he was then extending from gamma rays to X-rays. He scattered X-rays with a graphite block and caught them and measured their wavelengths, Mosley style, with a calcite crystal X-ray spectrograph. He found that the X-rays scattered by the graphite came out with wavelengths longer than their wavelengths going in, as if a shout bounced off a distant wall, came back bizarrely deepened to a lower pitch. If X-rays, light, were only a motion of waves, then their wavelengths would not have changed. Compton had in fact demonstrated in 1923 what Einstein had postulated in 1905, in his theory of the photoelectric effect, that light was wave, but also simultaneously particle. Photon. An X-ray photon had collided elastically with an electron, as billiard balls collide, had bounced off, and thereby given up some of its energy. The calcite crystal revealed the energy loss as a longer wavelength of X-ray light. Arnold Sommerfeld hailed the Compton effect, elastic scattering of a photon by an electron, as probably the most important discovery which could have been made in the current state of physics, because it proved that photons exist, which hardly anyone in 1923 yet believed, and demonstrated clearly the dual nature of light as both particle and wave. The subtle experimenter lost his subtlety when he shifted from doing science to proselytizing for God. Rigor slipped to Chautauqua logic, and he perpetrated such howlers as the notion that Heisenberg's uncertainty principle somehow extends beyond the dimensions of the atom into the human world and confirms free will. Bohr heard Compton's free will lecture when he visited the United States in the early 1930s and scoffed. Bohr spoke highly of Compton as a physicist and a man, a friend of the Danish laureate remembers, but he felt that Compton's philosophy was too primitive. Compton would like to say that for God there is no uncertainty principle. That is nonsense. In physics we do not talk about God, but about what we can know. If we are to speak of God, we must do so in an entirely different manner. In 1941, Warwick had already been kind to Arthur Compton's brother, moving Carl to national prominence within the science community and winning an important secret laboratory for MIT. Arthur wanted as much or more. There was the problem of pacifism, his mother's Mennonite creed, and a course much discussed at that time in American vestries, a churchly counterpart to isolationism. In 1940, my 48th year, I began to feel strongly my responsibility as a citizen for taking my part in the war that was then about to engulf my country, as it had already engulfed so much of the world. I talked, among others, with my minister in Chicago. He wondered why I was not supporting his appeal to the young people of our church to take a stand as pacifists. I replied in this manner: as long as I am convinced, as I am, that there are values worth more to me than my own life, I cannot in sincerity argue that it is wrong to run the risk of death or to inflict death if necessary in the defense of those values. Arthur Compton was ready then, a short time later, when Bush and the National Academy asked him to serve. The review committee met immediately with some of Briggs's associates in Washington. A week later, May 5, 1941, it met again in Cambridge to hear from other Uranium Committee members and from Bainbridge. There followed, writes Compton, 2 weeks spent in discussing the military possibilities of uranium with others who were actively interested. Compton worked quickly to complete a 7-page report and delivered it to Jewett on May 17th. The report began with the statement that the committee was concerned with the matter of possible military aspects of atomic fission, and listed 3 of those possibilities: production of violently radioactive materials, carried by airplanes to be scattered as bombs over enemy territory, a power source on submarines and other ships, and violently explosive bombs. Radioactive dust would need a year's preparation after the first successful production of a chain reaction, which meant not earlier than 1943. A power source would need at least 3 years after a chain reaction, Bombs required concentrating U-235 or possibly making plutonium in a chain reaction, so atomic bombs can hardly be anticipated before 1945. And that was that. No mention of fast neutron fission, or critical mass, or bomb assembly mechanisms. The bulk of the report discussed progress toward securing a chain reaction, and considered uranium graphite, uranium beryllium, and uranium heavy water systems. The committee proposed giving Fermi all the money he needed for his intermediate experiment and beyond. It also, more originally, discovered and emphasized the decisive long-range challenge of the new field. It would seem to us unlikely that the use of nuclear fission can become of military importance within less than 2 years. If, however, the chain reaction can be produced and controlled, it may rapidly become a determining factor in warfare. Looking, therefore, to a struggle which may continue for a decade or more, it is important that we gain the lead in this development. That nation which first produces and controls the process will have an advantage which will grow as its applications multiply. Bush was in the process of reorganizing government science when he received the NAS report. The NDRC, empowered equally with the military laboratories and the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, had served for research, but lacked the authority to pursue engineering development. Bush proposed a new umbrella agency with wide authority over all government science in the service of war, the Office of Scientific Research and Development. Its director, Bush, would report personally to Roosevelt. Bush prepared to move up to the OSRD by calling in Conant to take over the NDRC. And only after it was clear that I should shortly have a new position, writes Conant, did Bush begin to take me into his confidence as he pondered on what to do with the Briggs Committee. Against the background of his British experience, Conant told Bush his reaction to Compton's report was almost completely negative. Jewett had delivered the report to Bush with a cover letter, calling it authoritative and impressive. But privately, he cautioned Bush that he had a lurking fear that the report might be over-enthusiastic in parts and not so well-balanced. Jewett also passed it to several senior colleagues for comment, including the 1923 Nobel laureate in physics, Robert A. Millikan of Caltech, and sent their comments along to Bush in early June. Bush responded with exasperation, compounded with astonishing confusion about the developments in Britain. "This uranium business is a headache. I've looked over Millikan's comments, and it is quite clear that he wrote them without realizing the present situation. The British have apparently definitely established the possibility of a chain reaction with 238, which entirely changes the complexion of the whole affair. Millikan bases his comments on the conviction that only 235 holds promise. This is natural, since he has not been brought in touch with recent developments, which the British have told us about in great confidence." He agreed that the work ought to be handled in a somewhat more vigorous form, but he was still profoundly skeptical of its promise. "Even if the physicists get all that they expect, I believe that there is a very long period of engineering work of the most difficult nature before anything practical can come out of the matter, unless there is an explosive involved, which I very much doubt." The OSRD director was not yet convinced, despite new word of plutonium's remarkable feasibility. Segret and Seaborg had continued working through the spring of 1941 to determine the man-made element's various cross-sections. On Sunday, May 18th, having finally prepared a sample thin enough for accurate measurement, they counted